Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is a pioneer in her field. She's a world-leading experimental psychologist, an expert in the science of optimism and emotions, and a performance coach. She's currently a professor of psychology and head of the School of Psychology at the University of Adelaide. Somehow, she finds the time to write as well and has just released her latest book, Switchcraft, in which she explores the potential for all of us to master a set of skills we need to navigate a complex and uncertain world and restore our fulfillment, curiosity, and zest for life. It is my pleasure to welcome Elaine Fox to Great Australian Lives. Elaine, how are you going?
Hi, Laura. I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for that lovely introduction. It's great to be here.
It is such a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm fascinated to hear about what you have to say. Congratulations on the new book, Switchcraft. It couldn't come at a better time, could it really? I mean, we've been living in a world of heightened uncertainties, haven't we?
Absolutely, Laura. Yeah. And the interesting thing is when I started Switchcraft, it was actually way before any of us had heard of coronavirus. And so the book has become extremely timely, I think, as time has gone on. And as you said, you know, the reason why I wrote the book really is that, you know, the world is really uncertain and always has been to some extent. We obviously have had the coronavirus pandemic all around the world, which I think has brought this to all of our attention. Our worlds have been turned upside down, really, all around the world. We have lots of uncertainty going on, the war in Ukraine, you know, political upheavals everywhere. So, and this has come on the back of a pretty stable period, actually. Certainly in the developed world, there was a pretty stable period of time. So I think this has come as a bit of a shock to a lot of people, and it's very tough for people to cope, really. But I think one of the messages of Switchcraft is that we can cope. And in fact, we can do more than that. We can actually thrive in these times of uncertainty. And Laura, you know, if you think about it, like neither you or me would be here if we didn't, if we hadn't had ancestors who were highly agile and highly adaptable and were able to deal with all sorts of uncertainty. So that's really what Switchcraft is about. It's about using a set of skills to navigate a very complicated and kind of uncertain world. So it's really a toolbox for readers. And one of the real issues and one of the things that I bring out in Switchcraft is that there really is no one size fits all to deal with life's problems. We need a diverse range of skills and a diverse skill set to deal with the world. And I often use the analogy, Laura, of playing golf. I don't personally play golf myself, but I grew up actually in Dublin. You might hear from the accent, quite near a golf course. And I was always amazed at the number of golf clubs that people carried out onto a course. And of course, when you think about it, that makes sense. You need different clubs for different types of shots. If you're on the green, you need a putter. If you need long shots, you need a certain type of club. If you're trying to get out of a bunker, you need a different type of club. You can imagine trying to get around a whole course of golf with just one club. You know, you'd really be struggling a lot of the time. And life is very much like that. You know, life is also something that just requires lots of different techniques, lots of different ways of doing things. And Switchcraft is all about knowing what those techniques are and knowing the best one to use in the right situation.
Elaine Fox, let's call COVID the bunker. there's been so much talk throughout the pandemic of the damage of lockdowns and uncertainty have done on our mental health, on adolescents, on children, on everyone. But I feel like you're giving a different message here in that, you know, we can sort of use it to our advantage, or some people can come out stronger. Am I right?
Absolutely. We can certainly learn to live with uncertainty. And I totally agree. I mean, I do a lot of research in the mental health field, particularly with adolescents. And As you say, you know, there's been a lot of really, people are really struggling with their mental health during the pandemic, and particularly young people. Social isolation is very devastating for a teenager. I think we often hear about, you know, are we now going to be faced with a kind of an epidemic of mental health problems? But I think the interesting thing is there's no doubt that there are mental health problems. But actually, I think what a lot of the research in psychology shows us is that actually all of us are far more resilient than we think. You know, when we're thrown into a really crisis situation, actually the vast majority of us come through it pretty well. You know, it's not easy. It's never been easy. And, you know, the idea that somehow life should be easy is just a bit of a myth, really. But actually, given that life is difficult and we need to find ways around obstacles, what the research generally shows, you know, even after major traumas like, you know, terrorist attacks and traumas, the research shows that about 65 to 70% of people on average are actually very resilient. You know, about 10% develop severe mental health problems, and about 10% actually say they do better. It's called post-traumatic growth. They actually say they improve after the trauma. There's no doubt that actually, you know, most of us are actually much, much more resilient than we think.
Well, I've got to say, Elaine, without getting too deeply personal here, a few years ago, my sister passed away, and it was something that sort of absolutely, you know, broke my heart and will stay with me forever. Yeah. But I do have to say that I now, I'm pretty proud of the way I got through that and am able to continue on. And I often think to myself, you know, if something bad happens, well, I got through that, so I know that this is whatever this next thing is, you know, I can do pretty easily. So I certainly can relate to that. And I think a lot of people face different traumas in their life. And yeah, if you have the tools to get through one huge thing, then, you know, if we look at it that way, then you're right that we can get through the next challenge.
Absolutely. I'm really sorry to hear that, Laura. It's obviously a very difficult thing. But as you say, you know, things like that, unfortunately, happen to all of us. I also had an experience many years ago of somebody very close to me who passed away with cancer, and which was just totally devastating. And likewise, I was amazed at, you know, it took me a long time, and I had lots of false starts and, you know, made a lot of mistakes. But actually, over a year or 2 years, I did kind of get on my feet again and get over that. And I think that's what people find, and that's what the research shows, that actually, even though these are absolutely horrible situations to be in and nobody would wish it on anybody, the reality is actually we can overcome it. We need to find ways of overcoming it. And this is one of the things in witchcraft, that, you know, when we're under a lot of stress, our natural tendency is to try and seek out the familiar. And we tend to get quite rigid in our ways of thinking and in our ways of doing things. So witchcraft is all about trying to open yourself up and trying to be more flexible and adaptable and find different ways to get around the different problems. And I suppose kind of, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, Laura, in that situation, that, you know, having a lot of self-compassion, just realizing there's going to be times when you're feeling really bad and, you know, you're going to go off and do things that you wouldn't normally do, and you're going to really not want to talk to people. And that's all part of the recovery process.
I talked too much. I shared so much. I overshared, I reckon. A lot of people would think I couldn't stop talking about it when it happened. But that's just a way that you, different people grieve in different ways. Can you give us an example, Elaine Fox, can you give us an example of how people might, you know, look to use different tools and resources in a stressful situation than those that they are equipped with? What does the book tell us to do?
Sure. I think there's a number of things. I think, first of all, most of us are very uncomfortable with uncertainty and when situations get a little bit chaotic, which is very understandable. They're not nice situations to be in. But I think one of the things we can do, and we can do this not just when we're in a crisis, but kind of almost train ourselves, is to really, you know, try and get used to uncertainty, try and accept that actually uncertainty is a part of life. It's never going to go away. And, you know, it's been brought to the forefront with the pandemic, but actually it's always been there. You know, obviously with your experience and other experiences, you know, people do die. We might get ill. we might lose a job, you know, a partner might leave us. There's all sorts of things that happen that we're not expecting. So I think getting used to uncertainty, and psychologists use what they call behavioral experiments, which are very small ways of just exposing yourself to uncertainty. So, for example, if you're the kind of person who, you know, would never go to a restaurant with the type of food you've never eaten before, for example, you might think, oh, I couldn't bear that uncertainty, you know, I'd never do that. Just gradually start testing yourself, you know, try out these behavioral experiments. If you're a little bit socially anxious, you know, maybe just try to introduce yourself to people, try to go into an unfamiliar situation and gradually expose yourself to these kind of situations. And the big message in Switchcraft really is all about agility, just becoming more agile. And there's various ways we can work on our agility. One very simple way is to, you know, question our interpretations of the situation. So there's a lot of situations that upset us. For example, some are quite major, obviously, but some are quite minor. You know, maybe a friend doesn't call us back, for example. Maybe we had an angry exchange with a colleague at work. So, you know, I think what's helpful to readers, if you think back to an event that really upset you, and then try and come up with a different way of interpreting that. You know, maybe your friend is really unwell, maybe she's under a lot of pressure, you know, maybe your work colleague is got lots of problems going on in his life that you don't know about. So, you know, try and come up with different ways of interpreting that situation. And that kind of, if you do that on a fairly regular basis, it tends to kind of help people just develop different perspectives on things. Because, of course, a lot of life, particularly our social life, is really ambiguous. You know, there's lots of ways of interpreting it. And people who are prone to worry a lot and to be quite anxious, you know, when we become anxious, we tend to jump to the most negative conclusion. We tend to think, oh, my friend doesn't like me anymore. They're not interested. You know, that's why she's not ringing. You know, but actually, there may be other perfectly valid interpretations. So just learning to try and see things from different perspectives and practicing coming up with different ways of interpreting things can be a really good way of developing your kind of agility in terms of how you see things.
Fascinating stuff. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Elaine Fox, a cognitive psychologist by training and a leading mental health researcher. We'll head back to Elaine's childhood in Ireland in just a moment and find out where her passion for psychology all began.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Elaine Fox, head of the School of Psychology at the University of Adelaide, whose new book, Switchcraft, explores the potential for us all to harness the power of mental agility to transform our lives. Now, I would like Elaine Fox to come and live in my house and beat some mental agility into me. I think we all could use a bit of that, so feel a bit stronger in ourselves. But we all started at a place where we didn't know where we were going to be in our careers. We all started as kids with no idea. Elaine was one born in Dublin, Ireland. Elaine, what were some of your early childhood memories, and were there stressful experiences that sort of shaped you as a child in Ireland back then?
Yeah, thanks very much, Laura. It's as you say, I was born up in the north of Dublin, and actually I had a great childhood, really, despite the Irish weather. I mean, one of the reasons in Australia is for the weather, but despite the awful weather, I grew up beside the sea, just north of beautiful Dublin city, and there's beautiful beaches there and really nice cliff walks. And looking back now, I realised, you know, it was a very privileged childhood. And I had a kind of unusual upbringing in a sense, in that I think I was very lucky in that I had a very stable family environment. I was an only child, so I was just with my parents. But I had a kind of unusual background in that I grew up in an extremely affluent area of Dublin, but my parents were actually quite poor. It was quite a working class family. My dad had actually been a bus driver, and he kind of worked his way up to being a manager of a bus garage in Dublin. And he managed to buy a house when they had got married, which has been sold by the bus company. So, you know, he ended up kind of, it used to be an old tram station, actually. But it was in this very, very affluent area with, you know, really kind of big houses, multi-million pound houses that certainly my parents could never have afforded. So I had this kind of unusual situation in that most of my family were quite working class, quite poor and struggling for money a lot of the time. But most of my friends growing up were actually from very wealthy families. So I think that actually did me the world of good in many ways, because it meant that I came up seeing things from many different perspectives. You know, obviously I was very close to my family, and even though I didn't have brothers and sisters, I had about, I think, 30 cousins. You know, it was those days of the in Ireland where both my parents, I think my father had 13 siblings and my mother had about 9. So
Irish so Catholic I had families, many, many, am I guessing?
Absolutely.
Where did psychology come into your life? Were you had a really successful academic career, but did psychology kick that off, or did you start looking in another sort of profession?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because before I started psychology, I certainly didn't have a successful career in school. So I was in school in Dublin, and I was totally obsessed with horses growing up.
Right.
And really wanted to. I worked in various stables as a groom, and because my parents weren't very well off, it was obviously a very expensive hobby. So I had to kind of, you know, ride friends' horses. I worked in local stables, and I thought, this is going to be my life. I want to work in stables. But coming from a background where we didn't really have the money to do that, I realized kind of very quickly that, you know, it was going to be quite difficult. So actually, I think it was just in my last year of school, I kind of suddenly switched on very quickly, because, to be honest, I hadn't really studied very much. I did okay. I wasn't failing in exams, but I was always kind of, you know, pretty mediocre, not really doing brilliantly. But I knew I was kind of a bit brighter than that. You know, I could actually do better. So I think in the last year, I really thought, oh, you know, I better go to university. I better actually do something with my life, because not coming from a kind of well-off background, there wasn't a family business to go into. And I thought education is really, and my mother in particular really pushed me. She said, you know, education is one thing nobody can take away from you. So if you go to university, get a degree, at least that's a great start in life. So I thought, okay, I better actually start doing some work, start doing some study, which I did. And so basically I got an offer for general science or general arts in University College Dublin. And in those days, it was interesting, Laura, because in those days, we had this good system in Dublin where you could go to any lecture you wanted to in the first 3 weeks before you had to choose your subject. And I knew nothing about psychology, because psychology wasn't a school subject in those days. So you studied biology at school, or you studied. And so when I went to university, I really thought I want to study biology, because I'd loved biology in school. And it was either biology or geography were the two things that I was kind of interested in. But I went to lots of different lectures, and I popped into a lecture in psychology, and it turned out to be a lecture about visual illusions. And, you know, and it was absolutely fascinating and totally intriguing. And I was just completely captured. And I went to one or two other lectures, and they were on different topics. And of course, there's a lot of biology in psychology. There was a lecture I went to, which was all about the brain and how the brain works. And I thought, wow, this is a fascinating discipline, which I knew nothing about. So I just decided I'll sign up and I'll do psychology. And I did. And I've basically, here I am nearly 30 years later, still studying psychology. So I did my degree, and then I went on, I did a PhD. And then I've worked all my life really in psychology.
It's fascinating. And in 2013, you were at the University of Oxford, where you were for 10 years as a founder and director of the world-leading research centre exploring the nature of resilience and mental well-being. I find that just fascinating, how some people are more resilient than others. And I'm sure you would have found it remarkable too. I mean, even in, you know, sort of the hallowed halls of Oxford, you know, very esteemed institution in the world. Tell us about that experience being there and what you learnt there.
Yeah, it was a really great opportunity for me, actually, because I went to Oxford, as you say, in 2013, and I was very lucky that the following year I actually was awarded what's called a European Research Council fellowship. So there's these very nice fellowships from the European Union, which are obviously very competitive. You have to apply for them. But I was awarded one of those, which meant that I could set up a whole team of people. So I had during about 6 or 7 years of my time in Oxford, I had a team of about probably 10 to 12 people who were directly employed on that grant. And what we did was we were studying, what are the factors that lead some people to be more resilient than others? So we looked at a whole range of things. We were looking at genetics. We were looking at psychological aspects. We were looking at all sorts of things. And in fact, that's what I talk about really in Switchcraft. One of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was to bring a lot of that research to the general audience, really. And one of the things we found that's really important in terms of resilience is agility, this idea of mental agility. So one of the studies we did was we followed 500 children from the age of about 12 until they were 17. So we followed them for about 5 years across their secondary school years, basically. And as I said, we measured all sorts of things, including genetics and different things. But the thing that came out consistently was that those teenagers who are more agile and who are more able to find different solutions to their problems rather than be knocked back if one thing didn't work, they were the ones who were actually more resilient. So I realized that this kind of flexibility, this mental agility is really important. And we did lots of kind of experiments in the lab looking at that. We've got ways of measuring what we call task switching. So the idea that you can switch from one task to the other very rapidly. And we all do this. And one of the things, it was already kind of known, but we discovered in our research as well, is that multitasking is a total myth. You know, we might think we're multitasking, but actually what you're doing is switching very rapidly from one thing to the other.
Yeah.
And that kind of switching is very draining on mental resources. It's really draining of your physical energy. So one of the kind of tips I have in Switchcraft is I have lots of little exercises and things that people can do to help them switch more efficiently, and little games you can play to help you switch more efficiently from one thing to the other. One of the things, for example, to remember is that to switch tasks, to shift from one thing to another, you first have to kind of pull yourself away from one task. And people often forget that. People often finish one thing and then they jump straight into the next thing. And that's a disaster because your brain hasn't had a chance to catch up, really. So just having a little break, if you're doing, say, two or three different things, try and do one thing first and then just have a little break. Even if it's a cup of coffee, you know, stand up, walk around a little bit, maybe go outside for 5 minutes. Just having that break makes the world of difference. And then you can refocus on the next task. And that's a much, much more efficient way of dealing with kind of life. So Switchcraft is full of these little kind of tips and things you can do to help you deal with quite a complicated situation where you might have multiple different things, multiple different responsibilities.
I often think that I have three little children, Elaine Fox, two toddlers and a very small baby. The small baby is fine, but I often think being at home with them is far more exhausting than being at work, because not because it's, you know, you're traveling on the train or sitting in traffic or whatever, but you little kids, as you might know, and as everyone listening will know to some degree, one minute you're making a snack, at the same time you are doing one's hair, at the same time they're asking you to find their princess outfit, at the same time they've changed their mind, at the same time someone else is asking you to change the TV channel, at the same time you've got dinner cooking, at the same time it's like, I always think that I'm going from doing 15 different things at once. They're all menial tasks, making a sandwich, putting a princess outfit on, turning the vacuum cleaner on, but your brain's going, what, going from one thing to the next so quickly. That at the end of the day, you're just laying down in a heap on the floor, staring at the wall, thinking, what just happened? It's exhausting.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I can imagine. It's like a Switchcraft Academy, really, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Laura. It's, I think like every parent knows that you need lots of different techniques to support kids, really, like everything from discipline to ice cream. and as you say, there's multiple things going on. And I think there's no way of avoiding that. That's the other thing. You know, you obviously can't avoid all of that. But I think there are ways of managing that better. And you're trying to kind of just find those ways of managing those multiple tasks can really kind of help you and making sure you schedule in a bit of time for yourself. I think a lot of us forget that when we have these very busy lives that, you know, actually scheduling in a little bit of time, whether it's to go and do some exercise or go and chat to a friend or just go and sleep on the couch or whatever you want to do. I think that's what Switchcraft is all about. It's really about understanding the world around you very well. And we've talked a lot, Laura, about agility, which is obviously a really important part of Switchcraft. But the point I make in the book is that it's not agility just for its own sake. It's not about just being flexible because you can. It's a flexibility that's informed by three other things. There's three things that are really important. And one of those is self-awareness. And then emotional awareness, really understanding our emotions and really understanding your situation. So that's it's almost like a supercharged agility, if you like. If you have a very good understanding of yourself, your emotions and your surroundings, that will really help you to be much more agile in the right way. So, you know, picking the right task for the right situation is the key, rather than just kind of, you know, being flexible for its own sake.
Yeah, fascinating. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Elaine Fox, and there'll be more with her in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
I'm sure all of us know people who, no matter what life throws at them, they seem to be able to cope. These are the people who look on the bright side. I'm sure we also have friends and know people whose minds seem to be invaded by a negativity and a pessimism. At the more serious end, this can develop into anxiety and depression. These are people who just cannot seem to see the positive in life. So why is this? Why do we differ so much from each other in how pessimistic or how optimistic we are? Well, in my research over many years now, I've been trying to really find what is the core of these differences. Where do these differences come from? And the answer we found is actually rather surprising. A lot of people argued there may be an optimism gene. In fact, some of my own work has been called the discovery of the optimism gene. Genes are obviously important, but they're not the full story. And there certainly isn't a single gene that determines whether we're optimistic or not. Obviously, us humans are far more complex than that. There isn't a single gene that is going to determine our outlook on life, nor is there a single life event that is going to determine our outlook on life. But what is important is the fact that our brains are highly selective. We don't notice everything in the world. We notice some things much more than others. Now, if we go back several hundred years, William Shakespeare said that there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Now, could this possibly be true? Could how we think about things really make a difference to our outlook on life?
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Elaine Fox, one of the world's leading experimental psychologists, an expert in the science of optimism. We just heard a little of a presentation Elaine gave back in 2012 to promote her very successful book, Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. I'm sure we all wish we had the latter. 10 years from publishing that book, Elaine, has there been further research on an optimism gene or genes that some of us may or may not have? And where's our understanding of that at the moment?
Absolutely, Laura. Well, I've done a lot of research myself. And in fact, a lot of the research I was conducting at Oxford for my 10 years there was exactly on that, looking at whether there are particular sets of genes that tip people to be more optimistic or more pessimistic. And to cut a long story short, what we've actually found is that there are multiple genes, thousands of genes, that each have a very small effect. So there's no single gene that has a really big effect. It's almost like any given genes or even sets of genes, it's like throwing a tiny pebble into the ocean. Yeah, it'll have a little impact, but actually it's not going to really have much impact on the ocean. But all together, those genes can kind of make a difference. But I think the answer really is that there isn't a single gene. There isn't really. And the thing that we have found that really leads to optimism more and kind of pessimism is really how we process the world around us. you know, and that's really the key, I think. So whatever our kind of genetic makeup, we can, the one thing, what I kind of argued in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain was that we can't change our DNA. You know, we can't do much about that. We can't do too much about our environment. We can do a little bit, you know, in terms of where we live and the friends we have. But, you know, surprising things happen, unexpected things happen. But we can have some control of that. But the one thing we really can control is how we actually process information. And so I did a lot of work on what we call cognitive biases. So, you know, how we interpret the world around us, how we remember things from the past, and what we actually notice, you know, what we attend to. So again, a lot of people who are anxious, for example, will always tend to notice the most negative news stories in the newspaper, for example. They'll tune in on social media to all the negativity and never really to the positivity. And likewise, people who are prone to anxiety and depression will often remember the much more negative things that have happened to them in their lives. But they tend to selectively forget all the much more positive things. Mm. So they're the things we can work on. We can work on those kind of interpretations and memory biases. And that can really help us to develop a much more optimistic outlook. But I should kind of say, I suppose, Laura, that one of the messages in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain was that we absolutely need our rainy brain. So we have pessimism for a good reason. You know, pessimism is there to alert us to potential danger, to potential things that can go wrong. So it's about, you know, reading the situation a bit. And this is, of course, is something I pick up very much in Switchcraft, my latest book, where, you know, reading the situation, understanding the situation is really, really important. We often go around as if we have blinkers on and we don't notice things happening around us. I think Clive Woodward, who was the England rugby coach, made a great statement once. He said, when you go into a new job or a new situation, he said, the very first thing you should do is learn to read the tides. And I think that's really wise. So it's really, he said, before you start making any changes or start doing anything, just read the vibe, you know, read what's going on. And then that will help you to respond in the most appropriate way. So I think, you know, the message is we need to tune into that rainy brain because it's there for an important reason. But it's important not to let it overwhelm us. It's very easy to be overwhelmed by that kind of negativity. So getting that kind of balance, you know, between kind of pessimism and optimism. And it's very interesting. I was lucky enough to interview Michael J. Fox, the actor, when I was writing Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. I'd actually appeared in a documentary that he was making. So I went back and interviewed him about the book. And he's often said that, you know, he's an absolute born optimist. And your listeners may know that he developed Parkinson's disease when he was about 28 years old. So it was very tragic for him because he was obviously on a very successful trajectory in his acting career. And he said he kind of realized very quickly that he wouldn't be able to continue with being a Hollywood actor to the same extent. It just wasn't really possible. He said, no matter how big a star you are, you know, whole film crews aren't going to work around you. But he said a very interesting thing. He said he's always been very optimistic, but he said that didn't mean he wasn't pessimistic in the shorter term. Like he knew certain things wouldn't work out. He knew his acting career would really take a hit. He knew he possibly wouldn't be able to continue acting at all. He said he was very realistic and kind of pessimistic about that. But he said he never lost a general sense that over time things would work out well. He always had that sense that actually in the long run, whatever happens, it'll work out for me. And so that's the kind of the healthy type of optimism, if you like. It's a good dose of pessimism and realism, but also a kind of sense that actually you'll work it out. You'll figure out a way
to work things out. Overarching,
And that's exactly actually what Switchcraft is all about. Switchcraft is almost like the follow-up to that and really saying, well, okay, here's the ways we can actually do that. Here's kind of a toolkit, if you like, to help us figure it out.
Yeah, and find that bigger picture. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Professor Elaine Fox, whose new book, Switchcraft, is in stores now. Plenty more with her in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives. For Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives, our guest tonight is Elaine Fox, head of the School of Psychology at the University of Adelaide, whose new book, Switchcraft, explores the potential for us to harness the power of mental agility to transform our lives. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, Elaine Fox, but there is one question I really want to know from you. You recently have turned your hand to professional sort of performance coaching of some high-profile people. For those of us who feel like we're in a rut, in a slump, just can't sort of make a break in our careers or get ahead and really excel in the field, what's the one thing or mental sort of stuckness that you find with your clients, and how do you dig them out of it? How do you help them break ahead?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And you're absolutely right, Laura. We all get very stuck in rigid ways of doing things. And your question reminds me of one athlete I worked with, a British athlete, a young athlete who was very much on the way up. But her coach had said, you know, she's not really improving. You know, we're doing all the physical training, but she's not really improving to the extent she should be improving. So myself and my husband, Kevin, who we worked together with the athletes, we realized, having talked to her a lot and looked at things, we realized that actually she had a real fear of uncertainty. And as we talked about in the book in Switchcraft, we know that when we get stressed or anxious, we tend to look for the familiar. We try to not expose ourselves to uncertainty. So we realized that what she was doing in her training, she was either running against athletes who were nowhere near her standard of ability, so she could really, you know, beat them very, very easily, or she would train against people who are much, much better than her. So one person was actually an Olympic medalist, for example, and she was never expected to beat that person. Or she would go out and train with some of the men, for example, who are much faster than her. And so she would never be expected to win against those. And what we realized was she was never really exposing herself to training sessions or races where there were a lot of people around the same ability as her. And it was because of this fear of uncertainty. So we worked quite hard with her about, you know, gradually exposing herself and pushing herself out of her comfort zone a little bit more. So starting off maybe with, you know, people who are maybe not quite as good as her, but potentially could kind of be pretty similar to her, and gradually building that up so that she was actually going head to head against the people who really were very similar to her and possibly a little bit better than her. So I think that's a lesson for all of us, you know, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. It's not very new. I mean, we've all heard this before, but I think, you know, what I try to tell people really in Switchcraft is that it's about uncertainty. It's about our discomfort with being uncertain. And that's a disaster when we're dealing with uncertain times. You know, absolutely, we need to get more used and more comfortable to uncertainty. So I think really finding ways to gradually test yourself and push yourself out of your comfort zone can really make a huge difference to your life.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Elaine Fox, thank you so much for being on Great Australian Lives with us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. I wish we had 10 shows with you. There is so much more I want to explore, but we've run out of time. Thanks again, Elaine.
Thanks so much, Laura. It's been lovely talking to you, and thanks so much for inviting me on.
And of course, Elaine Fox's new book, Switchcraft, is available through Hatchet Australia or online, or you can connect with Elaine on Twitter and Instagram. And if you've enjoyed our chat with Elaine Fox tonight, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and share it with a friend. And join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.